Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're talking jargon-free money help with the folks from 2 Cents.
Today we have a great conversation lined up with Philip Olson and Julia Lorenz Olson. As a newly married couple, they transitioned from being theater kids fresh out of college to money experts as Philip and Julia now run their own financial planning firm in Texas, Austin, Texas. They also host the PBS YouTube channel 2 Cents, where they tackle various personal finance topics ranging from how cars keep you poor to retiring in your 30s. Man, those 2 Cents videos are so good because Julie and Philip, they cover and they illustrate these concepts in ways that are completely relatable. They make personal finance entertaining and easy to understand. So Philip and Julia, thank you for joining us today on the podcast.
For sure. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, guys. Yeah, excited to be here.
Well, we're excited you're here. And the first question we ask everybody who comes on the show, Matt and I, we like craft beer. And so
we're drinking one now.
We will intentionally spend, some people would consider too much money on good beer because it's really important to us, while we're also being intentional and saving and investing for the future. So we want to know from you, like, what's your splurge? What's your craft beer equivalent?
Oh, man. Well, it's probably apropos for, it's different for both of us for sure. But for me, it's definitely travel.
Nice.
And of course, I say that being in Puerto Rico, which is like my first, you know, post-vaccination travel. But even honestly, during the pandemic, we spent probably more than you would think because the fact that we work together, parent together, we're in a pretty small house, and like, you know, the intensity of quarantine, we actually made it a point to book like local Airbnbs for ourselves, like
nice.
Just for me and then just for Philip for like a weekend, probably once a month, just so
we
could get a little bit of a pressure release and have like a bit of a change of environment. It was really, really good for our mental health, and we were able to do that. So that was definitely still splurging during quarantine.
Very nice. Yeah. And what about you, Philip?
Well, I'd say craft beer is probably my number two, but my number one, I think, is mountain bike stuff. I got into biking about 3 years ago or so, and the amount of money you can pour into it is really, really stunning. So
it's serious.
Yes, that's where almost all my fun money goes.
Well, you guys can both be honorary members of the HTM tribe, but yeah, bikes and beers are like top on Matt and I's list too.
Nice. Travel's close there as well. So Philip, I mean, is it mountain biking specifically, just kind of like old school, or are you getting into like these new electric mountain bikes that can cost like $6,000?
Well, I have a full carbon enduro mountain bike that is way more expensive of a bike than I ever thought I'd have. I do have a buddy who just got an e-bike. He loves it. He can ride a lot further and a lot faster on that. And so we all kind of tear up the slopes. But yeah, mountain biking is definitely my love. I will spend some time on a road bike just for fitness and to get in shape for races, but that's, I don't really enjoy it as much.
Yeah, I feel like e-bikes, to me, it kind of feels like cheating.
So. I used to feel that way, but now I look at, you know, people who maybe don't have as much time to train or are not in as good of shape, and they can have just as much fun. So I'm kind of coming around to it, honestly.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly where
Stop
I am with
being
it.
Haters, people.
Like for me, it's if an individual can get on an e-bike, and that means that they can now commute to work on their bike when before it wasn't an option for them, right? For that reason alone, just that right there, I love what e-bikes are doing for individuals and their ability to commute. But guys, we would love to kind of get into your backstory a little bit. You know, y'all met during theater. Specifically, you were working backstage for a kid's dance show. But like, how in the world did y'all get from doing theater and acting to money and personal finance?
Oh, Lord. It was a strange and winding road, but I'll try and like keep it a post-it note version. So basically, you know, we did meet in college. I met him my second semester of my freshman year, and then we were actually married by my junior year. So we married super young. I had only just turned 20. My poor parents.
Wow.
I know. We were babies. And so, you know, our parents were, you know, emotionally supportive of us, but they were like, okay, if you're doing this, this early than you on your own, you know, like financially speaking. So we're like, okay, well, we can do this. Like, we'll figure it out. And, you know, both of us had been working, you know, part-time while we were in school, but it just basically shoved us out of the nest, I think, earlier than most of our compatriots. And so that combined with Philip getting a job that required him to have these kind of long treks in the car from like theater to theater teaching kids. He stumbled on, of course, as you do, Dave Ramsey. And he, you know, came home and was just kind of like talking about this guy who he was listening to. And I was like kind of intrigued. I was like, okay. And that just kind of started us down the rabbit hole of at least like working in like budgeting into our lives, right? And just like getting us familiar with the super, super basic tenets, right? Of like focusing your money. How much savings should you have? In what order do you do things? And so that was kind of the next step. And we kind of made money a little bit of a hobby for ourselves. And then both of us made a big transition about a decade ago. So we've been married for 14 years this year. And 10 years ago, we both found ourselves actually kind of recruited into the financial world. He was recruited to be like a financial advisor by like a, you know, big box firm. And I was recruited to be a loan officer, a mortgage loan officer. And so we just sort of like dove in head first, both of us almost at the same time. And we're just kind of like, you know, it was seriously sink or swim. And somehow we swam. We managed to swim and learned a whole lot. But mostly what we learned was like, oh, wow, the financial industry really sucks. It's not really out to help people like we thought it was. And so, you know, as we kind of matured in the businesses that we were both in, we sort of caught a vision of doing something a little differently, doing something that we designed, you know, figuring out how to help people directly, not by selling them products, you know. And eventually we found our way to owning our own, what's known as an RIA. And we have our own firm now, and we've been going for about a little over 5 years now, and it's been great. And then 2 Cents came into our lives about a little over 3 years ago as well. So it's been quite the journey.
So was like your foray into the financial services industry and kind of some of the things that you saw there that weren't too appealing, is that kind of what pushed you in the direction of opening up, you know, your own, you know, financial advisor service and then getting into the videos with 2 Cents? Was it like, we need to do something because so much of what people are hearing about personal finance is kind of broken?
Yeah, I'll tackle that one. Yeah. I mean, you pretty much nailed that exactly. The world we both swam in for something like 4 or 5 years in finance was very sales oriented, very commission product oriented. And so kind of the solution to everybody who came through your doors was some sort of product you would sell them, and not necessarily what they really needed, or not necessarily just advice. And that was tough because a lot of times what people really needed was just some wisdom, some advice, some encouragement. And there wasn't really a product for that exactly. And so we kind of bounced around in these sort of commission worlds for a number of years, both of us. And it was through a conversation with another financial planner probably 5, 6 years ago now, who was doing it a little bit differently. And I learned there's a whole kind of network of younger advisors who worked on a non-commission fee-only basis as fiduciaries for the clients. It was very exciting. And so kind of got the bug. And we've both been pretty entrepreneurial our whole lives. We've started multiple little side businesses and projects along the way. And so starting this firm was just another one, really. And it also gave us the freedom to start, you know, putting ourselves out there in a more creative way. So we have this performing background. We love to perform, love to be creative. And so pretty soon after starting the firm, we started creating our own essentially little finance, you know, low jargon, hopefully more accessible YouTube videos, just ourselves out of our house. And that kind of, you know, started to get a little better, and we got a little smarter of how we would do it. And that eventually kind of caught the eye of some other friends and collaborators and turned into the show that's now two cents with 500,000 subscribers. But that wasn't the plan. The plan was just to, you know, do something with a little more integrity that could help people better, in a more kind of to use our skills a little better.
Yeah, yeah, I love that. I love, and we're going to talk more about 2 cents here in a little bit, but you know, entrepreneurship is essentially what led you there. And Julia, at one point you had your own vintage clothing store. It
yes.
sounds like, yeah, that y'all had a number of small businesses over the years. And so like, what are some of the biggest lessons that you've learned, that y'all have learned together as entrepreneurs?
Oh boy, so many. And this is going to sound really, really trite, but it really is true. I think the biggest and hardest lesson to learn is that everything costs twice as much and takes twice as long as you think it will. Like everything. Creating a new product, hiring the right way, you know, like getting something off the ground. It just takes so much longer. It never goes to plan. But, you know, as long as you sort of set your expectations there, you'll be okay. You won't be shocked when, you know, something doesn't get off the ground. But also, I think that it's really important for people who do want to make a leap like this, you know, this idea that, oh, once you're an entrepreneur, that like you'll never work a day in your life. Like, that's total bogus. It is work. It's
not
work.
True.
And it's the hardest work, because I really do feel like businesses are so much like children. And now having one, like, yes, I can confirm. This is absolutely true. They go through these different phases. You know, there's like the infancy phase where, you know, all it's doing is taking from you. It's not creating anything worthy, like nothing, basically. And then, you know, as it matures, as it ages, it's able to do a little bit more for you. You can take a little bit more from it. You can ask something of it. But I think people have a really misguided notion that a business is just mature out the gate and they think they're going to be able to support their lives with it and, you know, yada, yada. And that is not true. It's really a long game. You really have to think about it like something you're bringing out into the world and helping mature.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, it's and even going to work some days, even when it's a project that you love, it feels like work. You know, even if you're passionate about it. Similar 100%. Thing if you love your kids, right? Like it's I love my children dearly. It's a lot of work to be a parent and to do it well.
Absolutely.
All right, so you guys do have a baby girl, and how has having a baby changed the money conversations y'all are having? Like, Have they changed quite a bit in the past few years since y'all have gotten into the parenthood game?
I'd say so, primarily around childcare. You know, childcare is expensive kind of however you do it. But when we are basically working effectively two different jobs, we're running our firm, both of us full time, and then also producing a series in addition to that, you know, it really felt like we had to make these tactical decisions about, are we willing to essentially take most of our discretionary income and pour it into having a nanny, really, so that our, you know, our kid can be well taken care of and that we can have some sanity and a little bit of free headspace at the end of the day. You know, that didn't seem like something I thought would be a huge factor before we had a kid, and it definitely is.
And childcare costs are through the roof.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So we're going to talk more about y'all's show. So you've got a personal finance show on YouTube that we mentioned, 2 cents. And we're going to talk more about that right after this break.
All right, we're back. We're talking with Philip and Julia from 2 cents, the hit PBS show that you could find all those videos on YouTube. And guys, y'all started creating videos on your own before you even joined up with PBS. The videos now look incredibly slick. They're super well done. But like, what made you want to start publishing that personal financial knowledge out in the world, would you say, in the first place?
Yeah, thanks for the kind words on that. So, you know, the beginning of this was when I worked as a more traditional financial advisor in a kind of a big box brokerage firm. There's a whole lot of restrictions about how you can market and advertise, really, because essentially the firms are nervous about liability. So I, as a freshly minted financial advisor trying to find clients, really had no way to get the word out and promote myself. And I would find myself daydreaming and just kind of wishing, boy, what if I could do whatever I wanted? And the way that would look really was using our performance and production and directing, you know, skills and backgrounds. We've produced shows, we've acted in shows, we have a lot of public speaking performance. Let's use that. So once kind of the shackles were off, that was the first thing we were excited to do. And you know, we had a very tiny audience, as anybody who's ever tried to start a YouTube channel on their own learns that, you know, 100 views is exciting at the beginning.
Like three digits. Yes.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I mean, we didn't have 1,000 views for a long time, to be perfectly honest. And I learned, you know, how to edit videos in the Adobe suite. I learned, you know, taught myself, and we got a green screen in our guest bedroom, and just kind of slowly chipped away at them, tried to make them a little better. And yeah, there were a couple different iterations of doing that, but it was really honestly very satisfying to finally start to put stuff out there, even though there's not much of an audience to say, you know, hopefully we can kind of stretch our legs a little bit here as experts in finance, hopefully help some people. Most of our shows at the beginning were just answering questions that people had asked us, and, you know, just see where it takes us. We didn't really have any plans beyond that, really.
Nice. So, I mean, essentially then, I mean, you were using the show as like a marketing platform, when you were starting the Art of Finance. So that's the name of your financial firm, right?
Yeah. So Art of Finance. So it's important that we kind of separate the two. So 2 Cents came in kind of as its own thing later on. But when we started the firm, we knew that as a marketing tool, we really wanted to create kind of some engaging, funny, educational videos. We knew we wanted to do that. And so we, you know, wrote them, and, you know, Philip learned all these, you know, editing tools. And so we made them, and basically the only place they lived was like on a teeny little YouTube channel, and we put them on Facebook, actually. That's where we first initially had it. And yeah, so, and then like Philip mentioned, a colleague of ours, a guy who had actually been my director in a production of Hamlet years prior, reached out and was like, hey, I've seen these videos, and I happen to I'm working on a PBS Digital Studio series, and I know they're looking like for new content. What would you think about pitching them personal finance show? And we were like, hell yes. Where do we, like, how does this work? What do we do? Because we're both like dyed in the wool PBS kids. Like, that's all both of our parents allowed us to watch. That's it. The end. Like, nothing else was allowed to be watched except PBS growing up. So we have, you know, extreme brand loyalty. And that was just like such a cool idea. And then it took another year and a half between pitching them the show and them actually saying, okay, let's do this. It was way longer than either of us thought. But
thus the twice as long as you were expecting.
That's the twice as long part coming into play. But really, it was important to us that the PBS show really remain, because we're getting paid to do it, you know, directly by PBS. And it just feels a little weird. Like, it's not primarily a marketing tool for us. It just isn't. Like, its
not at this
job
point,
is to educate people. Yes. So that's kind of where we wanted to keep it.
Love it.
Speaking of educating people, I feel like when you guys do these episodes, you're probably learning something yourselves too, because there's so much, it seems like there's a lot of research involved in creating these videos. And like, as for some of the videos you've created, which personal finance topic maybe surprised you the most, where you learned some stuff and you were like, I had no idea that was the case?
Yeah, you're 100% right about that. I would say we kind of powered through the things we knew really stone cold in probably the first 15 episodes, and we're just about to shoot our 100th episode. So we're learning about the topic generally ourselves first. It's not something we're already an expert on. And that's honestly been really fun. I think it's made us much better advisors. I throw back to our episodes all the time now when people ask me questions, because I'm like, oh, I've researched this for multiple weeks. I happen to know. Gosh, we learn a lot of crazy stuff every time. One that jumps out of me to me was, we've covered a couple of kind of trendier investment trends over the years. So we covered Bitcoin and we covered cannabis stocks when they were really hot and starting to get more legalized. And I was fascinated to learn how steeped in racism marijuana is. I had no idea. And that's basically the reason it's illegal is racism. So that's not really very financial, but I think that's it blew my mind.
One,
I had no idea.
One of the things that you discovered. One of the videos I saw up that seemed really interesting was you did one where you both went to financial therapy together.
Yes, that was my brainchild. Was it?
Oh, that's loved it. Can you explain to listeners like what does a financial therapist actually do? And then I would love to kind of hear your personal just experience with that counselor and maybe with making that episode as well.
Yeah, for sure. So we, both of us are huge, huge proponents of therapy and counseling. And, we started going like probably within the first year and a half of our marriage, and we have kept it up the entire time. There's just, there's no substitute for it. And I definitely think that all of that counseling and therapy has helped us, not only have a better marriage, but has definitely led to us having a better financial relationship, and it all kind of, builds up together. Mm-hmm. And so I really wanted to encourage people to think about how they feel about their money way more than they do. Most people are, focused on the strategy of it. They think like, oh, I just need the right spreadsheet and all my problems will be solved. It's like, nah, this thing is like you have a relationship with your money. And so I wanted to kind of show people by doing it ourselves that like, hey, thinking through how you feel about your money and being open about it and expressing it is so important to having a healthy relationship with your money. So I was listening to NPR, like you do, and I think it was on Marketplace where they interviewed a financial therapist and a person who was going to financial therapy. And I was like, what is this? I had no idea this was a thing. I would love to interview one for 2 cents. And there aren't a lot around, unfortunately. But the way I understand it is basically there's, kind of a certification that they can go through that basically just says like they've done a lot of work and research around specifically the emotions around money, also talking about, scarcity and how you grow up and all that. So they just have like particular expertise. And so I found one in Austin where we live, and I reached out to her to see if she would be open to doing an episode with us. And she said yes.
She didn't push back at all.
No.
She's like, y'all are maybe a little too qualified.
No, but I think that's the point, right? It's like I wanted people to know that we still deal with a bit of tension between ourselves, even though we're super practiced. Right. That doesn't mean we are perfectly self-aware on everything we do and why we do it.
And you really actually hit on a pretty important point there too, which is, we're putting ourselves out there as experts. We're professional financial planners. What the heck could we possibly have to learn or improve on? And it was actually tempting as we were creating that episode to go the route of, because we were going to, be in a session with her, go the route of, well, here's a thing that we're maybe 90% on. So let's get up to 100%. I mean, kind of like a, not really being very vulnerable and not showing a weakness. We decided to actually focus on something that actually is a major weakness for us financially speaking. And I think that ended up making the episode much more successful doing it that way, but it was a little scarier.
I feel like the thing that came up in the discussion was like the rates that you're charging clients, right? But there was kind of a bit of a cliffhanger at the end of that video.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Well, we hadn't actually, first of all, we actually decided that was going to be the topic the day we were shooting. So we had not actually given that a whole lot of thought in advance. And we put a couple out there and she said, let's go with the one that seems the scariest. And we said, okay, well, I guess that's what we're doing. And, this
easy
is
for you to say.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, well, honestly, she even says it's something she struggles with. The therapist we talked with, she said it off camera. And we work with a lot of small business owners and entrepreneurs. This is a massive stumbling block. I wouldn't say for all, but definitely most, which is feeling weird about raising your rates so high that it starts to say something uncomfortable about you. And that's where we were, which is like the amount we're charging isn't really enough to grow, but the amount we need to charge, which is like in the close to $300 an hour range, seems incredibly problematic. Like we're going to be too expensive for, you know, artists to be able to work with us. And it also seems incredibly greedy. And it seems like, who are we to be able to do this? There's just so many problematic money scripts involved in this. And boy, that was actually a life-changing experience, honestly, going through that. Even though we were on camera, even though it was somewhat of a setup, we did end up increasing our rates after that by a lot.
And okay, yeah, that was one. Like, what's the resolution? What did you guys do, and how do you feel about that now that you kind of like, you know, took the plunge to raise rates? How's that gone?
Yeah, so we didn't actually have a pay by the hour service at that time, but for the services we did offer, which were like a 6 month or 12 month long engagement or longer, we were charging somewhere in the $100 to $125 an hour range. And we realized, to make an hourly service work where we could meet for someone for just an hour or just an hour and a half, we'd have to charge so substantially more. So after that meeting, we had some strategic talks about it. It was like, what was the amount we would charge if we didn't care all what someone would think about us? If it was, if I had no fear and no judgment, what would that number be? And I was like, it's got to be more than 300. And we said, okay, let's figure out what 300 would be basically after taxes. And that's what we did. And then we landed on 320 or something, 325. And so we rolled it out. I was so nervous. The very first client we had that we met at that rate, I mean, was just falling over themselves with gratitude. And what an unbelievable deal it was that they were able to do this. And we've been doing it for almost a year now. Mm-hmm. And it is the most popular thing we do. It's like people are lining up down the street to do hourly work with us for $320 an hour. And it's crazy. I mean, it just blows my mind that we could have been doing that all along, but we were basically too afraid to. Julia is our salesperson, so she talks to everyone about this, and you get basically no pushback,
zero.
Right?
Zero pushback. Well,
that is awesome. Yeah.
That, I mean, sounds like that financial therapy was a game changer.
Big time game changer. I can't recommend it highly enough. It was incredible. We didn't even think we needed anything. And yeah, we obviously did.
Very cool. Well, yeah, that's awesome to hear. Really encouraging. And we're actually going to talk more about your own business there, the financial planning firm that y'all own there in Austin. And we'll get to that right after the break.
All right, we're back. We're still talking with Julia and Philip from the hit series 2 Cents on PBS. Guys, those videos obviously have been a major success. Some of them have over 1 million views. But while you guys are educating the masses, you also, as we've talked about, have this boutique financial advisory firm, and it specializes in particular in helping artists with their money. And yeah, I don't know. I'm curious to know more about what it looks like to help artists with their money. Do they have like specific financial needs maybe that are different than, you know, some of the other general members of the population?
I would say not really when it comes down to like nuts and bolts, but I think where artists and I would also broaden that a lot to say like just creative types. Mm-hmm. You know, you can be in any kind of, you know, workplace scenario and just know, like, it's like, you know, if you're a creative type or not. And I find the biggest thing that they lack and that they need is a sense of confidence and a sense of empowerment. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, I was totally one of those people who, you know, all through school, I struggled with math. I really did. And I'm a natural spender. I really enjoy spending my money. And I thought, oh, well, those two things combined just means I guess I'll just be poor the rest of my life, you know? That's it. And I, you know, through practice, through many years of, you know, budgeting and listening to somebody who, you know, I definitely think Dave Ramsey has his issues, but I think he is very good at bringing something that seems really complicated down to really like obtainable nuts and bolts. And I really appreciate that. And I benefited from that. And that's what people need. They really need to feel like this is not some big scary thing. There are some sophisticated tools that can help us, you know, get clearer on some stuff. But really what they need is some empathy for where they are, a place to talk about what they're scared about, and where they can know that they're safe and they're not being, you know, judged for not knowing something. So
that's what they really need. Yeah, talk more about that. Like, I mean, do you think that the financial world needs more empathy in general? Because, you know, that is one of the core components that you list on your site. Yeah, how does that play into the financial advice and talking through money with clients?
Oh, gosh, I think it's huge. Of course, we need more empathy. We need empathy for people who, you know, are really intimidated by this stuff, who are very scared. They don't want, like, no one wants to seem dumb, you know? It's super vulnerable to come in to a stranger and be like, oh, you know, most people are, you know, more likely to talk about like their sex life than they are their money, right? It's like the last kind of like hidden, really taboo thing that's like not okay to talk about. And so I think just providing a space of empathy for people, say it's all right to be a little scared, but, you know, we do what we can to make a really open, accepting environment and one where we will ask questions about their feelings, not just like, okay, well, when do you want to retire? You know, right, but asking.
Right. Here's your number. Save that much.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, people want that and they do need that. But also, like, hey, this money sitting over here that isn't doing anything, like, how do you feel about that? And it'll come out, you know, for example, I can think of somebody who's like, well, I inherited that because my sister passed, you know, completely unexpectedly. And I can't bring myself to spend it or invest it or do anything with it. And so I'm like, I can really understand that. So, you know, let's talk a little bit more about that, but I'm not going to push you. I'm not going to shove, you know, I'm not going to make you feel bad for not getting that invested and it's just sitting cash. Like, there's a lot going on here that, like, okay, maybe I can take this conversation to a certain level, but if I see, like, it would really, I think, benefit you to talk to a counselor about this, I will absolutely say that. And I've seen some really, really cool things happen just because we're patient with people and we meet them where they're at.
Yeah. Y'all are part of the XY Planning Network, which Matt and I, we refer people there if they want to find a financial advisor. We feel like that's one of the best places to go and find one. Your firm, you guys are fee-only fiduciaries. That's our favorite structure for people who want to hire a financial advisor. Philip, you hinted at this earlier, but what made you guys want to choose that business model? Why was that an important part of setting up your own business, having it, you know, essentially being fiduciary and fee-only?
Well, it's because we've been on the other side of it. I mean, I remember when Julia was doing her very best as she could as a mortgage loan officer, and she would say, you know, this couple coming in, they can get a mortgage, but that's not what they need. They need to get out of credit card debt, or they need to, you know, they need to do some probably more substantial things before we sell them this mortgage. And I had the exact same thing. I remember I would have clients, especially when there was a lot of numbers attached, when there was, you know, lots of zeros behind whatever we were doing. And the way I was compensated would be different depending on if they went left in the path or right on the path. And I tried so hard to tell myself, I think I did the right thing, and I don't think I let the compensation cloud my judgment. But at the end of the day, I'm not sure that's 100% true.
Right.
I think if you get paid five times more for someone doing one product versus another, I mean, you're thinking about your own well-being to some degree. And I thought, I got to find a way where if I tell you to pay off your student loans, or I tell you to go to Cancun, or I tell you to invest the money, my compensation's the same. That just feels very, very good. That's what I wanted the whole time when I was in the brokerage world. And so now I can't ever imagine going back, of course, but it's still a relatively small portion of the industry. I mean, most advisors are not that way. Most firms are not that way. So, you know, we're still a little bit of a tiny little rebellion within the changing industry.
Wait until the Empire Strikes Back.
They're going to crush you.
We'll have to regroup. Okay, so let's talk through when you would recommend for folks to actually go and see a financial advisor. You know, do you recommend that once you hit a certain life stage that you see an advisor? Or like, is it maybe once you've reached a specific net worth? When do you tell folks that, like, all right, it might be a good idea for you to seek some professional counsel in this way?
Yeah, you know, it can be a little tough because financial advisor is sort of a generic term, right? That can actually refer to a lot of different things. I mean, insurance salespeople refer to themselves as financial advisors, and bankers, and CPAs, all types of people, right? So the way I think about it is I would probably segment into maybe three different kind of sections. So I would say—
Ooh, I like it. Let's hear it.
The first one, probably the least known, is an accredited financial counselor. Julia is one of these. And this is a specialty that focuses on people who are sort of at the beginning stages of their financial journey. So maybe paying off debt, building up an emergency fund, trying to build up their credit score, sort of the basic couple of baby steps. And it's so important. And this designation is only maybe 5 to 10 years old. It's a relatively young designation. I think it's amazing. The people who are doing this are generally a lower price point, a lot more attainable for people just starting out. And I think that's where you should go if you haven't built up a net worth of, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars, if you don't have a gigantic income, but you just want some financial help. Credit financial counselors are fabulous, and they can be found, you know, through the AFC website and other places. The next one, so I would say probably the maybe most well-known, is a certified financial planner. That's what I am. If you're going to go talk with a certified financial planner, you're probably going to be focusing on more complicated tax things, more complicated retirement things, investment things, trust-related issues, saving for college. So you probably have a good amount of discretionary income, a good amount of investments, I would say close to $100,000 or more, and a good strong income. So CFP is definitely geared towards higher net worth, higher earning people. And then the third type I would just say is an investment advisor, which is a designation I also hold. This is just if you only want to focus on the investments alone. So you want someone to help you manage your portfolio, pick mutual funds, stocks, trade a portfolio, all that kind of good stuff. Investment advisor is going to do that. I would say most people calling themselves financial advisors are probably investment advisors, but obviously not all of them. It's going to be hard to find someone who will talk to you under $100,000. Most of them that are fee-only fiduciaries have a $1 million minimum, which I think is sort of problematic.
Yeah.
We don't have a minimum like that. But one thing that's great about the XY Plan Network that you mentioned is that they don't have any minimums like that. They actually can, every advisor there, and they're across all 50 states, they will serve clients on just a monthly retainer, sometimes as low as $100 or $200 a month. So nothing totally insane. You don't have to be a millionaire to work with somebody. Those are the three kind of that popped into my mind.
That's super helpful. Yeah. And two, I think just a lot of people, sometimes people need to sit down with one of those three types of folks. A lot of people, though, need the help and guidance that books and podcasts and, you know, mm-hmm. the 2 Cents video series can offer, right? It's that kind of stuff. So I'm thankful that you guys are also part of the good in the personal finance space of putting out free financial content that really helps people get those building blocks in order so that they can amass enough money that they actually at some point have the choice and the desire to be able to sit down with somebody professionally. So I love what you guys are doing. We really appreciate y'all joining us on the show today. How can our listeners find out more about you guys and what you're up to?
Yeah, well, obviously there's 2 Cents. So just, you know, on YouTube, 2 Cents PBS, we hang out there. And then there's our website, theartoffinance.biz. I'm finally writing the blog again. I'm so excited to be back. I could not handle writing for the blog and the show and parenting and dealing with quarantine all at the same time. So now that we have childcare, hey, in our life again, I felt ready to write. So I'll be doing some some stuff there. But if people have questions or wondering like if we could be a good fit with them, that's the place to go.
Well, Philip, Julia, y'all are the best. We appreciate y'all coming on the show. And thanks again.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
All right, Matt. Love the Two Cents folks, Julia and Philip. Great to catch up with them. And I love the way they bring jargon-free money help to the masses through the Two Cents videos. And like in a catchy, fun way. I'm a money nerd. I enjoy watching those videos, and I definitely highly recommend them to our audience.
They're even good for you.
They're even good for me. But yeah, so what was your big takeaway from this conversation with them?
Yeah, so I like the fact that, like, as we're talking about how they started doing their videos, their original 2 cent videos. I mean, I'm not even sure if they called them that at the very beginning. But
they did not, actually.
Yeah. And so they were doing it in an effort to, you know, educate folks for sure, but it was almost a way for them to kind of market their new firm, right? It sounded like they didn't have a whole lot of business early on, and so this was a way basically to get themselves out there. And now, I mean, we didn't dive into the, you know, we don't really dive into the numbers and the specifics, but it sounds like that they're, you know, they're getting paid decently, and they probably could, if they wanted to, go all in with PBS. They're having a lot of success there. And so for me, man, that just stood out as a small lesson, a small takeaway, I think, for anybody out there, that even though you may not exactly know what it is that you're trying to achieve, right? Well, at least for them, they did know. They just wanted to get their names out there. They wanted to promote the art of finance. But it morphed and it turned into this entirely new opportunity for them to do something that really speaks to them. You know, like, this is something that's a passion of theirs, acting and being in front of a camera, being on screen. And it makes me just incredibly happy that they found this. They have this outlet where they're able to exercise this creativity that they have, that they've always had. Julia, there's a bio where literally she said she was like raised on stage. And so she always thought that she was going to be a movie star or something along those lines. But instead she found herself underwriting mortgages. It's same thing with Philip. You know, he's driving around doing these different acting classes, different productions for kids. But for them to be able to take those two things, combine them together, and now they have this successful venture that is impacting a lot of people positively. A lot of folks are able to learn from their videos how to better their own personal finances. I think that is amazing.
And it's unique. What you can create is unique because you are unique. And I think, their history led them to be able to form what they formed. And it's really great. And I also to think that the first iteration is almost never like the finished successful product, right? Mm-hmm. And yeah, they went through a long time of making videos that were not 2 cents quality. They got very few views. And so sometimes you got to kind of stick it out because you're passionate about it. And they did, and it's led to something great. I think my big takeaway was early on in the episode when Philip said, the solution was the product, not the advice. When he was talking about working in the financial services industry, I think that is so often the case. And that's why we are reticent to tell people, go see a financial advisor for sure. Like, it is right for some people. And I love how Philip actually talked about it towards the end of the episode. Maybe the three different types of people you should consider seeing. And for some people, that accredited financial counselor might make more sense than like a registered financial advisor. Getting some more of those basic building blocks in order, but also too, some of those things you can learn for free via, like we said, some podcasts, YouTube videos. There's a lot of great free or incredibly cheap financial information out there that won't lead you astray.
Yeah.
The trick is finding it. And then the other trick is listening to it and taking action on it.
You know, I was going to say that's the third trick, is not just listening to it, but then actually putting what you heard into action. Because I think a lot of times that can be the most difficult part of things, is it could be easy to know what to do, but then actually following through and being disciplined about it. That can be, I think, one of the trickiest things, because there's a lot that I know that I should be doing. Like, for instance, I know I should probably be working out more, but I don't do it.
Yeah.
And so finding different folks who are talking about money in a way that will compel you, that will encourage you to actually take action, is really important.
Yeah. All right. Let's get back to the beer we had on the show, Matt. This one
yes,
was called
Let's Do It.
The Big Lestoutsky by Bramari Brewing. It's a white Russian stout. What was your take on this one?
One word, amazing, because you and I, we haven't had a stout on the show in a long time. It wasn't since, you know, it's like 6 months ago this past winter when we were drinking stouts. And so this was a nice break from the sours, from the IPAs that you and I have been enjoying. But dude, this was so stinking good. So it's like the Big Lebowski, right? And so his drink of choice was the White Russian. And the White Russian, this is such a long path to go down. But a White Russian is made with Kahlua, which is a coffee liqueur. And so this beer, it's a stout, but it is brewed. It is made with coffee. And it's got some vanilla, some lactose in there as well. So it's got like this nice creamy coffee nature to it. And it makes for just a really robust, delicious stout. But yeah, really enjoyed it, man. What were your thoughts?
I feel like this beer really tied the whole episode together. Kind of like that rug in the Big Lebowski.
This pulls the room together, right?
I feel like the dude while I'm drinking it. I feel nice and relaxed. And yeah, it was really
good. You have on your bathrobe and everything. Although I've got the hair these days. It's getting kind of long.
It's true. Yeah, I mean, I love the movie. I love me a White Russian and a White Russian in beer form. If executed well, which this one was, it's just an excellent style. It's a rare style, not one I've ever had before. So
yeah, I don't think I've had something like this before either, man.
Yeah, I was glad to try it. I thought it was delicious.
I feel like he'd be like, right on. And that's how I feel about this beer.
Yeah, no doubt. All right, well, that's going to do it for this episode. You can grab the show notes for it up on our website at howtomoney.com.
Yeah, that's right. We'll make sure to link to Philip and Julia's videos, although they are really easy to find. Like they said, you can just search for 2 cents on YouTube. And for anybody out there who has not left us a review, we would really appreciate it if you left us a solid one over at Apple Podcasts or wherever it is that you listen to your shows. So, Joel, buddy, that's going to be it for this episode. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.